Okay, we're starting here on the top of Kufayin Gimel of Aleph, six lines down. The Gemara here is continuing to discuss the Braita that we raised yesterday that seemingly is a stira on our Mishnah. We brought a Braita that indicates that Ein Motzim Alecherim. If you have two individuals with the same name, they cannot take out a shtar, they cannot be creditors against other parties. On the other hand, we saw in our Mishnah that the diuk that was made of our Mishnah was that they cannot be debtors. Other people cannot be creditors to these two individuals, but otherwise they themselves could be creditors to others. And the Gemara wanted to understand yesterday, by my kamiflegate, what's the machloka between our Mishnah and this Braita as to whether they can or cannot be creditors. The suggestion that we left off with yesterday was they were arguing about otiot niknot b'misira kamiflegate, that they're arguing about whether you could actually transfer ownership of the document to the other party. If you can transfer ownership to the other party, the mere fact that he's in possession of the document gives him right of collection. Because he could say that it's my document, it's mine to collect with, it's a bearer bond. And since it's a bearer bond, I have the right of collection. You can't deny my right to collection because you can't make a claim against me that I'm not really the entitled party. On the other hand, if you believe, then the debtor has a claim, which he could say is that this shtar is not really yours. It's a pikadon. The other Yosef ben Shimon left it with you, and now you're trying to collect with it, but you're not really the malveh. You're not really my creditor. And he can say to the other individual, you might be the creditor, but where's your shtar? So because of that, the Braita says that in that instance, they cannot collect from other people since the debtor has a claim against them since ein otiot niknot b'misira. And our Mishnah that believes otiot are niknot b'misira, then the person in possession of the document can collect with it, and the debtor really has no claim against him. He can't say that it's not yours, because just the mere possession of the document is enough to be classified as his. So that was what we left off with yesterday. And now the Gemara comes up with an alternative, six lines down. Some suggest here, t'kuli alma otiot niknot b'misira, that everybody agrees that the halacha is that otiot, a shtar, can be conveyed to another party simply by misira, handing it over to the other party. The other party can then become the owner of the shtar, the right to collect, the creditor in this case, simply by handing over the shtar to him. You can see in the Rashbam, he says, below shtar michira acher, without an additional shtar to indicate that you sold it, which is the opposing opinion to this, kedepaskina nuchata, like we pass in aloha, beperuk mocher tasfina karabi. This is the sheet of Rabbi, that otiot, niknot b'misira, you can pass a shtar simply by misira. Chachamim over there believe that you have to write an additional shtar in order to sell or to give over the rights of this shtar. So what the Rashbam is indicating here is that this Gemara, in saying that, ibaitema kuliyama, otiot, niknot b'misira, is following that psak halacha that we find in the other perek. Although many Rishonim struggle with our Gemara here because they believe, ain't otiot, niknot b'misira. And therefore, it's difficult to understand why the Gemara would have gone in this direction. Or in essence, the Gemara is now establishing a situation where we say Kuli Alma believes something that's not the halacha. So therefore, they struggle with dealing with this Gemara. What you have to suggest is that the Gemara is just trying to deal with a situation over here. It's not by saying the Kuli Alma that that's the halacha. It's simply saying that if you want to say that everybody would believe this way, then you could explain the machloket in the following manner, which is, v'hachu b'tzarich la viraya kamiflegei. Question is, do you have to bring evidence to the fact that you became into possession of this document? Tana didan savar in tzarich laviraya. Mere possession of the document is sufficient evidence that you are the owner of the document and that you are of the right of collection. It's in essence really a bearer bond. And since you are the bearer of the bond, you have a right of collection. Nobody can question the origins of the bond or how you came into possession of the bond. If you said you purchased it or was given to you, that's it. We don't have any more questions to that because you have the bond in your possession. Tana Bara Savar in the Braita, the author of the Braita says, Tzarich laviraya. We're going to demand that you bring additional evidence to the fact that this is your shtar, or you have a right of collection in this instance. So the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it over here is that the raya is edei misira, that you have edim to the fact that it was granted to you, that was masur to you. Vim enlo edei misira. And if you don't have those Eidei Misira, then you won't have a right of collection with this shtar. So that's the view of the Rabbeinu Gershom, that you need Eidim here. And without Eidim, we're not going to grant you the ability or the right to collect with this shtar. That would be the machloket. Our Tanavar Mishnah believes you don't need to bring that additional evidence. And so therefore, the mere possession of the shtar gives you a right of collection. The debtor can't really say anything to you. On the other hand, the author of the Braita believes that the debtor has a right to say to you, how did you come into possession of this? Show me evidence that this is your shtar. And therefore, you'd have to bring Edei Mesira to show or to demonstrate that this really is your shtar. And absent that evidence, you can't collect with that shtar. And that's why he says that Shtei Yosef ben Shimon Beir Achat, if one of them is a creditor, then the debtor can always make a claim against them to bring proof that he's really the owner of the shtar. And in this instance, there really will not be a deem to the fact that he's the owner of the shtar, because it wasn't necessarily not his shtar. And so he'll have trouble finding Edei Raya, and therefore he won't be able to collect with the shtar unless he presents those Edim. All right, so now Gemara continues, De Itmar, Otiot Niknot B'Mesira. In the case, or the situation of Otiot Niknot B'Mesira, Abaye Amar Tzarich Lavi Raya. Abaye believes that you have to bring evidence to the fact, or as to how you came into possession of the shtar. Rav Amar Ein Tzarich Lavi Raya. The other hand, Rav believes you do not have to bring that evidence. Now, as the Balei HaTosafot point out over here, even though it says De Itmar, which seems to connect between the statements here, or this Machloket Amoraim of Abaye and Rava, and to what we said before, which is the Machloket between our Mishnah and the Braita, nevertheless, the Balei HaTosafot point out that there is no correlation or connection between them. This is a completely independent Machloket. As he says here, Plukta de Matnitin Braita, Leta, but Plukta de Abaye Rava. There's no connection or correlation between the Machloket and the Braita and our Mishnah and that same Machloket, seemingly, that Abaye and Rava have. And that's because the Abaye Matzrich Raya. Even though Abaye over here says you did need evidence, he's Modeh Delo Chashin L'Nifila U'Pikadon Eched De Shmei Kishmei. He indicates in other places in the Gemara Nivamot that he doesn't worry about Nifila, the possibility that the Shtar will be dropped. But he doesn't worry about the fact that you would have deposited or given us a pikadon to another person when you have two individuals with the same name. So though, even though Abaye over here requires a raya, he does require you to bring evidence to Otiot Niknot B'Mesira, he will not agree with the Braita, because he believes, well, we don't worry about nefila, we don't worry about pikadon, and therefore there's nothing to worry about here. If the creditor shows up with the document, in all likelihood it is his document, and the debtor really has no claim against him. Even though he has a right to demand the raya, that's not similar to the Braita, which worries about this concept of pikadon, or worries about the fact that nifilan, that you're not the real creditor that's associated with this shtar. And number two is Rava himself over here, who says ein tzarich raya. He doesn't believe in otiot niknot b'misira. Rava himself paskins against the fact that otiot niknot b'misira. And so over here he's saying that ein tzarich ravi raya, but that's within what would have been seemingly the position of Otiot Niknot B'Mesira, because that was what Kulei Alma said before. So clearly, Rava is also not in concert with the Mishnah or the Braita, because he believes that ain't Otiot Niknot B'Mesira. And so therefore, the Balei Tosafot say that this machloka between Rava and Abaye over here is independent of the machloka between the Braita and the Mishnah, and the reasons for the positions of the Mishnah and the Braita are not necessarily correlated with the positions of Abaye and Rava. This happens to be that they're arguing about a similar concept or a similar idea about whether you have to bring evidence or substantiate the fact that the shtar is in your possession. Amar Abaye, mena amin Allah, how can I prove to you the fact that you do need proof or evidence of the fact that you came into possession of this shtar and it's not self-evident? Because when it comes to any other metaltalim, possession is the law, which is that if you're in possession of one of the metaltalim, then you are considered to be the balim of the metaltalim, and you don't have to explain how it came into your possession. On the other hand here, by a shtar, we do demand that you explain, or you give evidence of how it came into your possession, because here it's not simply that you are in possession of an object. Here you have to be the controlling interest, or the party that is empowered. Remember that a creditor has rights, not only to collect, but his rights in terms of his lien on the properties, his lien on the individual. And so then when he grants that shtar, this creditor, to another party to collect on his behalf or to become the creditor, he has to pass not only the document itself, the shtar itself, he has to pass to this individual everything embedded in the shtar. That's the shibud and everything else that comes along with it. So it's not just a simple, I have the shtar in my hand, I must be the owner of the shtar. That's true in terms of the paper value of the shtar. But in terms of the power of the shtar, that has to be given over in a proper mesira. So that's what Abaye says, you need evidence of that, or to back that, unlike a regular case of mitautalim. Detanyo, have a brayta. Echad menachim, sheshtar chov yotzei mitachad yado. So you have a situation in which brothers inherited the estate from their father. They're still jointly involved in the estate. They haven't divided up the estate. And then one of the brothers has a credit note, which entitles him to collection that is either written in his father's name, that his father was the malve, or it was another party that had the rights of collection, and now since they're in possession of it, they can collect instead or in lieu of that party, because they become like the creditors over here. So in that instance, this individual, one brother, says, my father gave me this credit note, or this credit note belongs to me, and not to the estate as a whole, and not to the other brothers. He has to bring evidence or proof to the fact that he is the rightful owner of the shtar, and that the shtar does not belong to the estate as a whole, to all the brothers as a whole. So you see over here, even though he's in possession of the document, and they can make a claim that it was masur, he had a mesira, and therefore he should have the right of collection, nevertheless, we demand that he bring evidence to the fact as to how he came into possession of this document. My love, what would you think from this, or what would you extrapolate from this? Huadin achrine. It's true not only by brothers, but it's true by people at large. That if you make a claim of otiot niknot b'misira, coming into possession of a document, you have to bring proof or evidence to the fact that you actually came legally into possession of this document, or how you came into possession of this document. Rav amar, shani achim. Brothers are different to shamtu mehadodi, because they slip away from each other. They pull assets from each other, or in essence, they are together in a pool of assets, and so there is a little bit of horse trading going on, a little bit of taking more by this individual, by the other individual. The way that Resh Beinu Gershom describes it over here is, Yad kol echad gonev me'echav, each one of them steals from his other brothers, demora hetera, because he basically justifies his position, latzmo lefi shiureshu. He says, I'm an inheritor just like they're inheritors, and I have an entitlement to use it just like they have an entitlement to use it, and I'll use it the way I want to use it. And so people are more heter, they justify to themselves taking a bigger chunk of more than they deserve, but goes around and comes around. I mean, all the brothers are doing that, so in essence you hope that it's evening out, but because of that nature or the behavior of individuals in the estate, therefore we require that he brings a raya, because people aren't trustworthy in these situations. That's why we made evidence. But in a normal case, we wouldn't demand evidence. If you're in possession of the shtar and you say it was masur to you, then we would have no reason to question that. And so that's why Rova rejects the proof that Abaye brings. Higadamre. So there's some that say that the proof that Abaye brought is really a proof to Rova. Amar Rova menamin Allah. How can I prove to you that you do not have to bring evidence of how you came into possession of the shtar? Tanya, echad menachim, sheshtar chov yotzei mitachat yado. One of the brothers who has a shtar chov that he says is uniquely his, even though they're to join together in the estate and they all inherited it from their father, alav lavi raya. The burden of proof is on him to show that he is uniquely in possession of this document. Rava makes the diuk, or similar to what he said before, which is, achim hu dishamtu mehadodi. It's only true by brothers who are moreheter, or take liberties, justified to themselves, taking assets from the estate. And that's why we have to be careful over here. We demand proof over here. Aval achrine, dealing with third parties, independent parties, lo, that would not be the case, because they don't steal from each other, and therefore we would not assume that the person needs evidence as to how he came into possession of this item. Rabaye, how does Rabaye respond to this proof of Rava? Achin, it's trichale. Achin is a unique case where we need to tell you about it. Kasakadat chamin, I would have thought, came to shamtu me'adodi, since they steal from each other. They justify, take liberties in taking assets from each other. Eimim izdar zehire. Since everybody's aware that that's what's going on, they're all looking over each other's shoulders. They're always checking up on each other. And therefore, if the guy shows up with the document, you would have thought that there's no way you could have pulled off taking that document to himself without anybody else noticing it or knowing about it. Never, maybe over there, we would believe him, even without evidence. Velo tzrich lavi raya, and he won't have to bring any evidence. Kamash balan. That we don't say that, and even by Achin, we do demand he bring evidence as to how he came into possession of the shtar. So now, we have an explanation for the difference in views in our Mishnah versus the Braita. Our Mishnah, which says that they can be creditors to Yosef ben Shimon, is because our Mishnah believes that you don't have to bring evidence as how you came into possession of the shtar. Your mere possession of the shtar gives you a right of collection. And so therefore, if you're possessor of the shtar, the debtor has no claim. The Braita, on the other hand, believes that you have to bring a raya as to how you came into possession of it. If you don't bring a raya, then you don't have a right of collection. The debtor can say, it's simply a pikadon with you. You aren't the rightful owner. There's another Yosef ben Shimon. And we're choshesh that you might have come into possession of this document improperly. Because we worry about nefilah, the fact that one Yosef ben Shimon might have dropped the document, the other Yosef ben Shimon picked it up. And we worry about the possibility that it was a pikadon. And therefore, the author of the Braita demands that you verify your ownership over here. Because of all these chashashot. As we noted before, that Abai and Rav are also arguing about a similar question as to whether tzirich raya, although the impetus for the necessity of the raya is not driven by the fact that we are choshish for nefilah or we are choshish for pikadon, but rather a simple question as to whether a person who's holding a shtar has to bring evidence to the kinyan that gave them the right to have this shtar in their possession. Now that has ramifications in halacha because generally we paskin like Rava. And Rava over here says, Eino tzarich lavi raya. But we also paskin that, Eino tiot niknei b'misira. You can't simply acquire shtar through misira, and therefore you would need an additional shtar to acquire this shtar. And so then the question arises, does that have implications the halacha when Rava's statement was said under the rubric of something that is not the halacha? So the Migash and his Talmud, the Rambam, believe that Rava does have implications. And therefore, if you show up with a shtar, you do not have to bring evidence as to how you came into possession of that shtar, or what kinyan you used to come into possession of that shtar. So even though we don't accept the underlying premise over here of otiot niknot v'misira, nevertheless, Rava's statement of eino tzarich raya has relevance with shtarot in general. And you don't have to bring evidence or a ra'aya to how you came into possession or the kinyan that you used to come into possession of the shtar. Although the Rambam does qualify that and say, if the debtor does challenge the creditor in this case, he will have to bring evidence to the fact that he is the rightful creditor or collector over here. And then the Ramban and the Rishonei Ashkenaz think that Rava's whole din here is irrelevant because Rava's din was only set in the context of otiot niknot b'misira. But in a case of ein otiot niknot b'misira, then Rava's din is not relevant at all. And therefore, anytime you present the shtar, you also have to bring evidence of how you came into possession of the shtar, how you made a kinyan on that shtar. And that's the psak halacha brought by the Ramban Shulchan Aruch Ella. But now we run into another problem, which is there's a third braita, ha detanya. So now we have a three-way machloket of our Mishnah, the braita we previously quoted, and now a new braita. Kishem shimotzim hein shtarchov al acherim. Just like Yosef ben Shimon and Yosef ben Shimon have the right to be creditors to other parties, kach motzim zelzeh, they could even make claims against each other. Now this is very difficult to understand. Because even if you can explain why they can be creditors to other parties, it's hard to explain why they could be creditors to each other. There's a huge risk in terms of them being creditors one to the other. But Mike Miflege, so what is the machloket here to explain, or how do we explain this braita that says that all this is permissible? So Gemara says, V'kotvim shtar l'loveh, v'afu pishein malveh yimoka miflege. The machloket is whether the sofer is entitled or permitted to write a document on behalf of the loveh, on behalf of the debtor, when the malveh, when the creditor is not present. Tana didan savar, the author of our Mishnah, the Tana of our Mishnah says, kotzvin shtar loveh, afu pi she'ein malveh imo. We do write shtarot for the debtor, even though the malveh is not present, because it is a schut for the malveh, it's to the benefit of the malveh. So if the loveh is telling you to write a document that creates a liability for him, then of course he would do it. He's not doing anything to anyone else's detriment. He's only doing it to his own detriment. Zimnin de azel de gabi safros. Visade. Problem is, sometimes he'll go to the sofer and brings the edim. Va'amar lehu kitvu li ishtara. De be'in on the mezaf me Yosef ben Shimon chavri. So he says, listen, draw up the document and sign the document because I'm about to go borrow money, my good friend, Yosef ben Shimon. After he writes it and has it signed, so now he has a full-fledged document with the sofer and the edim thinking that he's the debtor. Nikitale, he holds on to it for himself. He's going to act as the creditor and say, please pay back the money that you borrowed from me. From me, meaning from Yosef ben Shimon, which is his name, as well as the other party's name. So here you have the problem, which is one Yosef ben Shimon is borrowing money from the other Yosef ben Shimon. So now, you have an issue in terms of who's the creditor and who's the debtor. So when he goes to the sofer, he comes in with the ploy or pretending to be the debtor. And therefore he has the sofer draw up a document that says Yosef ben Shimon borrowed money from Yosef ben Shimon. After he leaves the sofer, he takes the contract and flips it around and says, I am the creditor and you are the debtor. It's hard to tell because both the creditor and the debtor are both named Yosef ben Shimon. And so therefore we're afraid, or the fear we have here is that if the sofer writes these independent documents for the loveh, there's a risk here that the loveh can flip that and become the malveh and then try to extract money from the other Yosef ben Shimon. Given that that's a possibility, our Tana, or the Tana of our Mishnah, says no opening up documents or credit documents against each other when you share a common name. Tana Bara Savar, on the other hand, the author of the Braita here, who says that it is permissible for them to take out documents and to borrow and claim against each other. He has a principle that we won't write up or draw up a shtar for the loveh when the malveh is not accompanying him. So now you don't have this fear. You don't have this fear that he could come in pretending to be a debtor and then have the document created and then flip it into his being a creditor. And since you don't have that fear because the sofer can't write without the presence of both the loveh and the malveh, you don't have that issue. And therefore, they can claims against each other that explain the reasoning behind the third braita that we brought. So then, the Gemara at least views the machloket, or the reason behind why in our Mishnah they're not allowed to make claims against each other or have documents against each other, is because of this problem of whether we draw up documents for the loveh independent of the malveh. On the other hand, if you remember from yesterday when we read the Mishnah, we read or we explained it with the reasoning that the Rashbam gave on the Mishnah, which was the fact that the risk of allowing them to take out documents one on the other is the fact that maybe one was a creditor and the other one was a debtor. Then the debtor repaid the money and the creditor hands the shtar to the debtor, because that's what you do. When you get paid back, you get the shtar back so that he can't make a claim against you. So the debtor gets the shtar back from the creditor and then he turns around and makes it into the fact that he's the creditor now and tries to collect from the other Yosef ben Shimon with the same document. And so that was what the Rashbam says the fear is. And that has a slight nafkamina between what the Gemara is proposing over here versus what the Rashbam said in the Mishnah. And that is the certain documents that can't be drawn up without the Malveh being present. So according to the way the Gemara is explaining it, if you have a situation in which it's a document that the Malveh must be present for, then even the Tana of our Mishnah will agree in that case they can have documents against each other or with them being the two parties to the document, because there's no chashash, since these are documents that we won't allow the Levet to write up without the Malveh being present. On the other hand, the reasoning of the Rashbam would be irrespective of that. The reasoning of the Rashbam would apply even in a situation in which the Malveh and the Levet have to be present for the writing of the document. Because the problem here is not the drawing up of the document, it's the fact that at the end or the termination of the loan, the Malveh is going to give the document to the Levet. And then the Loveh here can turn around and then make himself into the Malveh. So, according to the Rashbam, would be problematic, even though it's a situation in which both the Malveh and the Loveh would have to be present for the drawing up of the contract. It still doesn't solve the problem from later on when he has to return the document to the Loveh. So that would be a nafkamina between the reason that the Rashbam brought on the Mishnah and what's being brought here by the Gemara. Right. Your point is well taken, which is that the Roman Shulchan Aruch actually quotes this as a nafkamina between the reasoning of the Rashbam and the reasoning brought by the Gemara. But the Shach over there makes your point and says that in general, we would expect the debtor to rip up the shtar. And since we'd expect him to rip up the shtar, he doesn't really have a claim over here. So he says that even according to the Rashbam, only in a shtar that you write for the Loveh without the Malveh can he say that, look, I didn't really worry about ripping it up because I know that you wouldn't rely on this shtar afterwards. Since it can be written or the shtar can be drawn up without the presence of the Malveh, I didn't take care or I didn't make the effort to rip it up because I knew you guys wouldn't rely on the shtar. But in a situation where the Malveh has to be present and the Loveh is there, then, in that case, it's incumbent upon the Loveh to rip up the shtar. If he doesn't rip up the shtar, he's really causing himself the loss in that case. And therefore, the Rashbam would agree that it's only in a case where you draw up the contract alone for the Loveh that we worry about this problem of him not ripping up the shtar, because he can make the claim that I thought I didn't need to rip up the shtar because I didn't think you would believe or put any credence in this shtar. Right now, the Gemara continues with the remainder of the Mishnah, which is Nimtza Lechad ben shtarotav, shtaro shel Yosef ben Shimon parua. So if he finds amongst his documents of credit, here is all his rights to collection. In the middle of the pile, it says that the shtar of Yosef ben Shimon was already paid. Shtarot shnehem truim. Then if he has a document that entitles him to collection, or he's lent money to both Yosef ben Shimon's in town, the fact that he has a receipt that says Yosef ben Shimon paid back the money, then neither of them are now obligated to pay him in this instance, because he doesn't know which one, and each one of them can claim that they were the one who repaid the money. Now, it is somewhat problematic, because as the Rashbam notes over here, the Gemara in Bava Metzia says that if you find a shover, if you find a receipt in the hands of the malveh, in the hands of the creditor, we'd assume that it is not a real receipt, or that it's not a valuable receipt. The receipt was drawn up by the creditor in order to give it to the debtor, but that means that he never gave it to the debtor. And so the malveh can always just say, any simpon, as the Gemara in Bava Metzia calls it, any shover, any receipt that's in his possession, we would have just assumed that he was writing it in order to give it, or he was writing it for the future, but not that there was a real repayment, and that's why he's in possession of this receipt. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia says, he says, Okim na lahach mishno hatam. Our mishno is explained over there in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Kagon shenimtza shtar ben shtorotav kruim. The case where he finds the shover amongst, or he finds the shtarot of these individuals amongst other shtarot that he has that are ripped up. So it's in a pile, or there's other circumstantial evidence that seems to indicate that these shtarot were repaid already. So if we put together the fact that he has the shover, and there's this circumstantial evidence that these obligations are found, other shtarot that are ripped up, in that case, we will say that in all likelihood, the shover was real, and one of these documents was repaid, and since we don't know which one it is, he can't come with a claim against either party. Now, of course, if the parties come and voluntarily want to pay, the individual doesn't have to say to them, listen, you don't have to pay me. All he has to note is if they say to him, we already repaid you, then both of them have the opportunity to make that claim. It means that they're both now availed of that claim to say that the receipt is theirs. But that assumes that they're making a claim that they already repaid the money. But if one of them is not making that claim, and he comes to pay, we're going to assume he's paying because he thinks he owes the money and he wasn't the one about whom the receipt was written. So now the Gemara says, Taima dinimtza. The reason is because he found it. Halo nimtza, had he not found a shover, had he not found a receipt, matzi mapik, he would have the ability to take these shtarot and claim against Yosef ben Shimon with these shtarot. Vehanan, our Mishnah says the opposite earlier on the Mishnah. Velo acher yacholo tzialehem shtar chov. None. That's what it says in our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that the individuals in the city don't have a right to be creditors to either of the Yosef ben Shimons because they can never come and make a claim for collection because the debtor can always say, that's not me, it's the other individual. So if that's the case, how come you're saying in the Seifa that it's only because he had a receipt that he doesn't have a right of collection? But had he not had the receipt, he would have had a right of collection. So how do you square those two parts of the Mishnah? Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah b'mishulashim. That's a case where the shtarot include three generations. Or again, there's a differentiation. It's Yosef ben Shimon ben Yaakov. And it's Yosef ben Shimon ben Naphtali. So now we have the shtarot that clearly indicate that they are different individuals who are the people being claimed against over here. V'nechzei Tavra Bishmadamat Dichtiv. So if that's the case, then you already have three generations in each of the shtarot that show or indicate as to what right we have to collect over here, or the creditor has to collect over here, then say the same thing about the shover. Just look at the shover and see, is it Yosef ben Shimon ben Yaakov, or is it Yosef ben Shimon ben Naphtali? And then you'll know which shtar the shover is connected to. Where it says, Amar Boshaya b'mishulashim b'shtar v'im mishulashim b'shover. It's a case where they have three generations associated with the shtarot, but they don't have three generations associated with the shover. So one of the shtarot says that Yosef ben Shimon ben Yaakov owes me 1,000 zuz. And then there's another shtar that says Yosef ben Shimon ben Naphtali owes me 1,000 zuz. And then there's a shover, there's a receipt there that says I received payment from Yosef ben Shimon of 1,000 zuz. So in that case, we don't know which of the two Yosef ben Shimons the shover belongs to. And so that's the doubt that is being created over here. And that's why neither of them has to repay. Abaya Amar Hochikamar. This is how to read it. Nimtza lelove ben shterotav. It's not that the malveh, the creditor, found the receipt amongst his shterot, but rather the love found amongst his shterot. Shishtero shel Yosef ben Shimon alai parua. And there's a receipt there that says that the creditor, Yosef ben Shimon, who has a claim against me, was repaid. Shterot shnehem pruim. And the shterot of both of them are considered to be repaid. So here, in a case where there are two Yosef ben Shimons, who are creditors to this lovet, to this debtor, if he has a document, a shover, a receipt in there that says that I repaid, or I've already paid back Yosef ben Shimon, then that will suffice to protect him from having either one of the Yosef ben Shimons make a claim against him, because he can in either case say this receipt is for that payment, or this receipt is for that payment. So neither of them have a definitive claim against him anymore because he has this receipt in hand. So in this case, Abaye just flips the possessor of the shover from the malveh to the loveh, and that makes it much easier, because then you don't have the problem with the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which says that when you have a receipt in the hands of the malveh, that we don't consider it to be a real receipt. And that's why we had to come up with this ukimta to suggest that in our case over here, it's a case where it was amongst the ripped up shtarot, or in a place that gives circumstantial evidence as to why these shtarot might be considered to be repaid, or why the shover should apply to them. But for Abaye, who says that the shover is in the possession of the loveh, you don't have any of those issues. The fact that it's in the possession of the loveh is where it's supposed to be. But now it just gives him rights to use that receipt to fend off both Yosef ben Shimon's, because no matter who comes to him, he can say, look, I have a receipt for the repayment of the debt. And now we can also read the Mishnah more simply without this part of the Mishnah being a stira to the diuk we made before, that these individuals have the right to take out shtarot against other parties, as well as the fact that we don't have to set up the case where there are three generations noted on these shtarot. Now, as the Rashbam points out here and in other places, if they generate the harsha'ah, if they give a power of attorney to each other, therefore they come as a single entity to collect, then in that case you can't deny them collection because they have the rights or coming as a single entity to claim. I mean, manavshach, the debtor does owe one of the two parties money. He only has one receipt and he has two loans outstanding. So it's clear that he only has a receipt for one of the two loans. And therefore, if they can somehow join their claim together against Lovin, they will have a right of collection. And I would just suggest that I think in that case, it would be the lower of the two shtarot that they have a claim to. Since the loveh can say that the receipt relates to the larger sum, so then the smaller sum would be the one that they could, if they came into a harsha'ah, collect or force collection of that amount. Although the Rashbam does qualify and say here, even if they come with a harsha'ah, and miu, itain loveh, and the debtor says over here, ve'omer l'shnehem parati, I paid both of you back, and the deceit does not have enough information to discern which Yosef and Shimon had spoken about. Rashbam says, I think that the debtor here has a fair claim, even if they come with a harsha'ah, even if they come together as a single entity to collect, if the loveh makes a statement that he owes neither party the money, then the shover, which is written without any indication as to which of the two it refers to, then in that case, the lovet, if he makes a bari claim, can fend off both creditors, even if they come with a harsha'ah. But if the lovet agrees that there were two loans outstanding here, and he only has a receipt for one of them, then as long as they don't come with a harsha'ah, he has a way to fend off the creditor. As soon as they come with a harsha'ah, then he would have to deal with those parties, and at least agree to pay the lower of the two outstanding debts. Right now, the Gemara continues and says in the Mishnah, what is the solution to the problem if you have two people with the same name? Ketzed yasu yishaleshu. What should they do? They should go then onto a third generation. So our Mishnah gives a hierarchy of how to deal with these issues, which is that first you have a third generation of names. If the third generation of names is similar, then we say that you should use a physical character trait. And if the physical character traits are the same, then you should use their title, Kohen. Now what happens if those are all the same too? Tana, imayushnehem Kohanim. If they are both Kohanim, and the same would be true if they were both Yisraelim, as the Bali Tosafot point out, but it's just following the hierarchy that was noted in our Mishnah that said the title was a Kohen. Then how do you differentiate? Ichtavu dorot. Then you go to a fourth generation. So not only go to his grandfather, you go to his great-grandfather. And as the Rashbam says over here, there's very low likelihood that people would have the same name, same father's name, same grandfather's name, and same great-grandfather's name. That's a low enough probability that if you already put four dorot into the document, then it's pretty clear about whom the document is written. All right, so now, next case. Omer livno, shtar ben shtarutai parua. An individual who is mitzaveh mishum mita, he's on his deathbed, and he tells his son that one of the documents that I have here is repaid. Ve'eni yodeya ezehu. And I don't know which one it is. I'm not sure as to which of the documents has been repaid. Shtarot kulan pruin. The son has no right of collection now. He cannot go out and try to collect any of the monies here or with any of the shtarot here because we don't know which shtar was repaid. And here the Rishbam says that even though this individual can technically collect from all these individuals, it's only one of them that he doesn't have a right of collection. Nevertheless, he is unwilling to take that risk because he says, V'alove heminani v'lo exarti shtarot. The loved, the debtor, believed me that I wouldn't come and collect from him again. And so therefore, even though I don't have a claim against him, I still have the shtar in my pile because he left it with me. But I don't know which one it is. Veni rotzeh li'anish. And I'm scared of getting punished. I don't want to steal from anybody. I don't want to take the money from anybody. And so because of that, basically you can't claim against any of these debtors anymore because I just don't know which of the debtors has already repaid me. And therefore, shtarot kulan pruin, we consider all the documents to be as if repaid. Chutz, shimotan shiomru adayin lo peranu. And here the Rashbam qualifies this, and we mentioned this before, that if the debtors say we haven't repaid yet, or they come to repay, you can accept payment from them. We'll assume that those aren't the ones who already repaid. So if they come voluntarily to repay, or they say we haven't repaid it, then we will allow them to repay in that situation. If one debtor has two documents there, meaning that he has two outstanding loans with this creditor, Hagadol Parua Vakatan Ina Parua. Mimanavshach, the father said that only one of the debts that was there, one of the documents, was repaid. So given that information, if there are two outstanding credit loans to this individual, only one of the two could have been repaid. And since it's a motzi mechavero laveraya, we'll assume that it was the higher amount that was repaid, and therefore the individual will be obligated to pay the lower amount, because mimanavshach, one of these two contracts is not repaid, and we'll give you the benefit of the doubt, because it's motzi mechavero laveraya, and therefore you can claim that it was the smaller amount that was still outstanding, and it was the larger amount that was repaid. Amarova, shtar lecha biyadi parua. If an individual says that the shtar that you have in my hand is paid off, hagadol parua vakatan ena parua. In that instance, then we assume that if he has two outstanding debts with this individual, we assume that it's the larger debt that's been repaid and the smaller debt that has not been repaid. Chov lecha biyadi parua. If he says that the outstanding liability that you have with me is paid off, shtarot kulan pruin. Then all the shtarot are considered to be repaid, even if there are multiple outstanding loans with a single individual. So here, Rava points out that our Mishnah is only true when he says specifically the word shtar. Because in that case, when you have a single shtar that is repaid, there's a possibility if an individual has two shtarot, meaning that he has two outstanding debts with this individual, then only one of the two would be considered to be repaid. And that would be the larger of the two, because we give him the benefit of the doubt. But in a case where the language he uses is all the liabilities that you have in my hand are paid off, then liabilities subsumes within it even multiple shtarot. It means everything you owe me has been repaid. That could be in multiple shtarot. And therefore, even if you have multiple shtarot, kulan peruim, we assume that they're all repaid and you can't collect from anybody. Amar le Ravina the Rova. So Ravina says the Rova, if you look in the Rishbam, he has a girsa of Amar le Ravina the Rav Ashi. Elamiato. If that's the case, sadi mechura lecha. If a person says, I'm selling you my field, sade gadola mechurado, then the largest field is sold to him. Sade shiyeshli mechuradacha, he says, the sade that I have is sold to you, kos todav mechurino, then we're going to say that all of his fields are sold to this individual. Here, what he's suggesting is that the language of sade, and you can see this in the Rishbam, can he be used both in the singular form, which is when he says, Sadi, my field is sold to you. That's a single field, and we're going to assume that it's the larger of the fields that he sold. But if he says, Sadeh sheyeshli mechura lecha, over there he's using the word Sadeh, like it's used in Tanakh sometimes, which is the singular word is meant to plural. For instance, when we say Behema Rabba, or Stay Edom, there we're not speaking about a single field, you're speaking about large tracts of fields, or a plurality of fields, or a large number of animals. Behema Rabba is obviously not one animal, it really means Behemot Rabot. But that's the way that the terminology is used. So that's the way he's using the word Sadeh over here when he says Sadeh Sheishli Mechur Lecha. He's saying, Sadeh, all the land that I own, basically, is sold to you. So what Ravina is pointing out to Rava is that if you use the term in the singular form, if you use chov or shtar, that should only apply to one item. Chov should not apply to all outstanding liabilities. It should be the chov. The liability in the singular form was repaid. It doesn't mean the liability in the greater sense that all liabilities were repaid. And so Dovir, he says, if you extrapolate from your saying, you're going to reach this ridiculous conclusion, which is that you can use a word like sadeh, which has meaning of being a singular, but yet then you can explain it as being in the plurality and say that the word sadeh now means not just my field or a particular field, it means all of my fields, just like the chov means all of my outstanding liabilities. So Rava answers him and says the two cases are not comparable. Patam yad balashtar la tachtona. Over there, the balashtar gets worse of the situation, and similarly over here, it's true in both cases. Yad balashtar is on the tachtona. The claimant has the lower hand here, and the claimant is the one who's burdened by a motzi mechavero alav haraya. So in the case of a sale, the balashtar is the lokeach, is the buyer, and so therefore the buyer is the one who's obligated to bring proof. If he can't bring proof, he's going to let the lesser of the explanations. So then we're going to explain the word sadeh to refer to a particular field, and not sadeh to refer to all of his fields. On the other hand, by the case of chov, where the individual is waiving the liability, so then the person who's coming to collect is the motzi mechavero alav haraya. So now, if he wants to collect, after saying that the liability was repaid, then he's got to prove that he meant liability in the singular and not liabilities in the plural. And then he's got to bring evidence to the fact that when he said the word chov, he really meant one chov, the singular, and not chov in the plurality. Because we're going to assume that the malveh, in this case, forgave everything, unless he can prove or demonstrate the fact that he has a right to collect more than that. Because yad balashtar la tachtona, the one who's trying to make the claim, has the lower hand in these situations because the burden of proof is on him. So in essence, you come out with an opposite approach or opposite situation here because of the fact that the context or the one who's trying to extract the money is different in each of these cases. Person who lends money to his friend with a guarantor, the malveh, the creditor, should not go after the arev, guarantor. Ve'im amarlo, if the creditor said, amanat shepara mi she'ertzeh, the condition of the loan here is that I will collect from whomever I choose, which means whether it's the arev or the loveh, yipara min arev, then he has a right to go collect even from the arev first, because that was the stipulation of the loan. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, im yesh nichasim leloveh, if the loveh has possessions, has an ability to repay it, ben kach u ben kach lo yiparah min ha'arev, then the malveh should not go after the guarantor in this case. He should go after the loveh. Even when he has a right to go after mi she'erteh, whoever I choose, still he should favor going after the loveh. V'chein haya Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel omer, and similarly, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel has a similar position in this matter. Harev l'isha biktubata, someone who's a guarantor of the husband's need to pay his wife her ktuba, vaya bala migersha, and it was a case where the husband was divorcing her, but the husband is penniless and he can't pay the ktuba, so now she comes to collect from the harev, from the guarantor, in order to get her ktuba. Yedirena hana'a. The arev, the guarantor, has a right to demand that the husband take a neder to make his wife a surah in hana'a to him, And he has to do it al dat rabim, which is a neder that can never be overturned, overruled, or kerahatarat nidarim, because shema yasu knunya al nechasim et shelzeh. Because what we fear is that there's collusion here between the husband and wife to basically extract assets from the arev, the azirat ishto. And as soon as they get the money, he'll take his wife back. So it could be a plan that was hatched by the husband and wife to say, listen, we are penniless, and if we stay like this, we're not going to make it anywhere. So let's get divorced. If we get divorced now, this arev is going to be on the hook. So I can go collect my ketubah. I'll collect my ketubah after the divorce based on the arev's guaranteeing of my ketubah. And then after we get the property, we'll get married again and we'll live happily ever after. So in essence, what they're doing is they're colluding to take the money or the properties away from the arev. And so what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says is that in order to protect the arev in this situation from paying and being abused in this situation, we tell the Baal, the husband, to take a neder anav, which will then preclude him from getting any benefit from this woman in the future. And that means that he will not be able to remarry her. He will not be able to reestablish ties with this woman. And then we won't have to worry about this issue of collusion, because there's going to be a permanent divorce or permanent separation between these two parties. So now, even though technically there's no connection between the two cases, except for the fact that it's both Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in these cases, the fact that the mission says v'chein seems to indicate that there must be some commonality or something that joins these two together. And it is the fact that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in general looks out for the rights or benefit of the arev. And just like in the first part of the Mishnah, he was looking out for the arev and saying it's the lovei's property, you gotta go after him first. So in the latter part of the Mishnah, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is saying that if the husband is getting divorced from his wife, the arev is entitled to ask the husband to take a neder hana'ah to ensure that they are not colluding to extract the property from him and then get remarried. So my time, the Gemara wants to know why in the beginning of the Mishnah does it say when the creditor comes to collect money, he may not go to the guarantor first. He has to go to the loveh, he has to go to the debtor first. So Rabbi Rav Yosef Damrei Tavayu, Rabbi Rav Yosef Posei, Gavra Ashlimit Li, Gavra Ashlimi Lach. He says, listen, you gave me a person, and I'm giving you back a person. And as the Rashbam explains over here, the basic idea is that the arev is not guaranteeing the payment of the outstanding debt. What he is warranting or guaranteeing is that the loveh will be present to collect from. And in essence, what he's saying is, listen, if the loveh is not present, and he disappears somewhere, he passed away, and he can't repay the loan, then I'm on the hook for that because I can't bring you the loveh. On the other hand, if I can present the loveh to you and I basically guarantee that the loveh will be present, then in that case, I'm not responsible for any payment. And that's what Rabbi Yosef is suggesting over here. The reason the arev is off the hook is because the arev presented the loveh. The loveh is here, and as long as the loveh is present and the malveh, the creditor, can take him to court or can deal with the loveh, then the arev has fulfilled his obligation, which is to present the individual here. So only in an instance where the debtor passed away or skipped town would the arev be on the hook. But otherwise, the arev would not be on the hook. And that's what our Mishnah is saying, that you have to go to the loveh and not the arev. So Matkiv L'Rav Nachman Hadina de Parsai. That explanation of Rabbi Rav Yosef is like the laws of the Persians. Mar says, Adarabo. Butter arva azle. What are you talking about? In Persian law, there is no requirement to go after the debtor first. You can go straight after the arev. So what Rabbi Rav Yosef is saying has nothing to do, or is not similar in any way, to the Persian laws. Elak beidina parsai. Their explanation is like that of a Persian court. Delo yavi taima lemitzayu, which they issue decrees without explaining the logic behind them. Or they issue decrees that are illogical. And so what Rav Nachman is saying is that you're no different than a Persian Beit Din randomly comes up with solutions or conclusions in the law. These Persian courts have no guiding principles, or they don't logically explain their positions. So too, this idea that an arev has no responsibility in repayment of the loan, that's of a similar ilk to these judgments or decrees that are handed down by the Persian courts. Hello, Amar Rav Nachman. Ma lo yipara min ha'arev. So then, Rav Nachman suggests, then what is the meaning of lo yipara min ha'arev in our Mishnah? Lo yidva arev tchila. You do not have a right to go to collect from the arev in the first place. Meaning that you have to first go to the loveh, and only afterwards go to the arev. Tanya Rabbi Yochi, we have a brayta that supports that understanding. Amalvet chaveiro al yedei arev, person who lends money to his friend using a guarantor, lo yidba arev tchila. You don't have a right to go to the guarantor first to get repayment. V'mamar amanat she'pera mi she'erze. If the condition, the stipulation of the malvet when he extended the loan is that I will collect from whoever I choose, yidba arev tchila. You have a right to collect from the arev even in the first place because that was the condition of the loan. Now, Amar Rav Huna, minayin arev demishtabed. How do you know that an arev is encumbered or has an obligation to pay? The way that the Rashbam says it over here, the question of the Gemara is, be'amira ba'alma below kinyan. How is it, or why is it that the arev, through a simple verbalization that he is guaranteeing the loan, is obligated based on that statement? That's the way that the Rashbam views the question of the Gemara. Absent what the Rashbam says, you could see the Gemara's question here about the Shibud of the Arev as a more simple question, which is, how do you know that the guarantee of the guarantor is binding on him, and that he really has to pay the money, and he wasn't simply saying things to facilitate the loan, but it didn't really obligate him. It's true that the two are probably linked, because the obligation of the Arev is generated by his Haftacha, by his promise or his guaranteeing of the loan, but you could make enough kamina that even in a case where he writes down his commitment to be the guarantor, the question would be, why is he committed or why is he obligated in that case? So Runa explains it's from the pasuk, Anochi Ervenu, Miadi Tivakshenu. This is the pasuk that is found by Yehuda when he's trying to convince his father to let him take Binyamin back down to Mitzrayim so that they can go buy food and help them to survive. So there he makes a promise, which is, Anochi Ervenu, I will guarantee him to you. Miyadi tivakshenu. And then you can demand him from me. And I am personally guaranteeing the fact that he will return. And so even though this case is not identical to what we're looking for, which is a guarantee of a loan, nevertheless, it defines the term arev for us. And in this instance, we'll say that an arev can enter into a situation or obligate himself in a situation, either according to Rashbam, orally, verbally, like Yehuda did, or through a commitment to another party. And so that's how we prove from here that the arev can obligate himself simply through that commitment.
So Mati Vlar of Chista, Rav Chista says, that's not a case of arevut. Ha, kablanuti. That's a case of kablanut. Dichtiv. Because it says in the pasuk, Tnu oto al yadi, v'ani ashivenu. So this pasuk is actually found by Reuven. When Reuven, when they first came back, tried to convince Yaakov to send Binyamin down with him, he says that, Tnu oto al yadi, give him to me, hand over Binyamin to me, v'ani ashivenu, and I will guarantee or I will ensure that he returns to you. And if not, then you have the right to kill my two children. Yaakov rejects that offer of Reuven, but then when Yehuda comes later and makes the offer again, but there he, instead of offering up his kids as the guarantee, offers himself up as the guarantee. What Rav Chista is pointing out over here is that Yehuda's claim is built on top of what Reuven already offered. So Yehuda, when he is bringing about his guarantee, he's building that on what Reuven had requested, which is Tnu oto al yadi. And in that case, it generates kablanut and not arevut. The difference being that a kablan comes into possession of the object. He basically takes possession of the object and then guarantees to give it back. But his guarantee in that case is because he became a possessor of the object itself. And we'll see later in today's Gemara, in tomorrow's Gemara, that kablanut, for that reason, takes on a different responsibility with regards to the guarantor. He becomes almost a primary figure, along with the loveh, or even maybe more primary than the loveh, because he's the conduit for that which happens. In that case, he is really the quote-unquote borrower, and then he is giving it over to the loveh. So he becomes the conduit for that, or he actually becomes on the hook for that which is transpiring. And so that's what Rav Chista is saying to Rav Huna. Listen, your proof from Yehuda is not such a great proof, because there Yehuda is acting as a kablan. He's physically taking Binyamin. He's getting Binyamin into his possession, and then he's guaranteeing him when the object is in his possession. Versus your classic case of Arevut, where the individual obligates himself, the way the Rashbam says it, Be'amira, or the way that we explained before, just simply his commitment as an Arev generates an obligation. And that's different, or where does that obligation come? Because here he doesn't come into possession of anything. You learn it out from here. Mekach Bigdo is
shirt was taken off of his back, ki arab zar, because he was a guarantor to another party, and because of a foreigner, they came and plundered his property or took his possessions. And this individual lost money because he guaranteed a loan to someone else. And as the Rashbam over here points out, that nowhere in the Pasuk does it indicate that he came into possession or he made any kinyan. It's simply his commitment as an arev that obligated him in this case. According to Rashbam, it was the Amira. According to the other Rishonim, it was the commitment to be an arev. As the Rabbeinu Gershom says over here, Alma de Mishtabda. You see from the Pasuk that you are successful at creating that arevut, and that's why he's losing the shirt, that's why he's losing out over here, because he successfully became a guarantor of the loan, and now that the loved defaulted, he's now on the hook for it. And that was sufficient for him to lose the shirt off his back, because he guaranteed these other individuals. Ve'omer, and in addition to that it says, B'ni, imaravta l'reyacha, takata l'zar kapecha, kashta b'imreificha, nilkata b'imreificha. And be safe, kibata b'kaf reyacha, because now you're ensnared in the palm of your friend's hand. Lechit rapes, urahav reyacha. So this is a pasuk actually that's quoted in the Gemara in Yoma with regards to doing tshuva. The Gemara darshins it to be dealing with two different tracks, that there is a person here who got himself into trouble or obligated himself because he was an arev. He was a guarantor. But now, he gets himself into trouble in one of two ways. Either gets himself into trouble because he spoke up in order to be an arev, to be a guarantor, and therefore he was nilkadata b'imreificha. He was caught in the words of his mouth, that which he stated or made himself into an arev, now put him into a predicament where he's going to have to make payment. So, if that's the case, imaravta l'reyacha, then the best thing to do is, because now you're ensnared by your friend, loosen your hand, pay the money that you owe in this case, and keep your word as a guarantor. There's another track in the Pasuk, which is, you said something that hurt your friend's feelings, that slighted your friend. So now you want to undo that or solve that problem. Then I say zote fo benivin atzel. This is what you should do in order to save yourself. Rahav reyacha. Placate your friend. Or the way that the Gemara darshins it is, harbe alav chavirim. You should have many people intercede on your behalf and try to convince him to forgive you for that which you said or the slight that you had done to him. But here you clearly see that Imrei Ficha, the words of your mouth, are what create the Arevut over here, which create the guarantee that gets you into trouble in that Pasuk. And the way that Chazal Darsh in the Pasuk is, V'imamo nishto b'yadecha, if his money is in your hand, because he's the creditor and you're the one who's guaranteeing the loan, Hoter lo pisat yad, open up your hand and pay what you owe. V'imlav, if that's not the problem, but rather that which you said is the problem, then you should bring lots of individuals to intercede on your behalf and try to beseech this individual to forgive you. Amar Abaye, Arev de Mishtabed Machloket Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. The fact that an Arev has the ability to obligate himself in the liability that could be associated with the default of the Loveh, that is really subject to the Machloket Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi that we saw before, about whether asmachta kanya or not, whether an asmachta works as a full-fledged kinyan. So this is a classic case of asmachta, which is here the individual relied on the fact that he really wouldn't have to ever step in. The reason he guaranteed the loan is because he never thought he would have to actually pay out on the loan. And that's why he went ahead and guaranteed it. But then it turns out that he was wrong, and the loved defaulted on this, something that he never expected. Something that he never intended. Is he really on the hook for his promise to repay at this point? So that's a classic case of asmachta, where you thought or relied on something in order to take action, and then it turns out that that didn't come true. And even though within the Bali and Tosafot we saw before the possibility that when you're tole b'dat acherim, where your whole condition relies on other people, in that case, we would not consider it to be asmachta, because in essence, you relinquish control, because you know you have no control over here, and therefore it's handed over to the other individual. But, nevertheless, in this case, we might consider it to be a smachta, because he relies on their friendship or the goodwill that is generated between them in order to obligate himself, and therefore he really is relying on this individual to repay and not really relinquishing his control over the situation to the other party. But based on that, the Rabbi Yossi, Damar Asmachta Kanyo, according to Rabbi Yossi, who says that Asmachta is a good kinyan, Arev Mishtabet, then an Arev would be obligated because he made a promise that he didn't think he would ever have to keep, and now when he has to keep it, he's obligated. Rabbi Yehuda, Damar Asmachta Lo Kanyo, according to Rabbi Yehuda, who says that an Asmachta is not a valid form of kinyan, Arev lo mishkabet, then a guarantor would not be obligated to stand by his word. Amalei Ravashi the Amemer, so Ravashi challenges a Amemer and says, Amasim b'chol yom, it's a daily fact, that asmachta lo kanyo, that we pass in like Rabbi Yehuda, that asmachta lo kanyo, the Arev mishkabet. And despite the fact that we pass in that asmachta lo kanyo, we still think that guarantors are obligated to make payment, or to stand up to their guarantee of any loan. Elo Amar Ravashi behahu ana dekamehemin le gamar umishtabed nafshei. The reason that the arev is obligated in this case is because there is consideration. That's the main point. In order for a person to obligate themselves or have gemirat adat, they require certain consideration in order to make it that they will commit with a full heart, and therefore will no longer be an asmachto. And that's what Ravashi says over here. The fact that you honored this individual as being the guarantor, which means that both parties see this person as a trustworthy individual and a reliable individual. So the fact that you chose them to be the guarantor gives them a certain feeling or good feeling about the fact that they are considered to be trustworthy individuals. And that hana will be sufficient consideration for the arev then to obligate himself to repayment of the liabilities in a full-hearted manner. As the Rashbam says over here, "Mishtabed b'leiv shalem," that's full-heartedly he enters himself into this agreement. "Vishlichuto de'arev ka'ovid malveh," and it's as if the malveh, the creditor, is acting as an agent for the arev. "Kilhu atzmo loveh," as if he himself is the borrower, the debtor over here. He is encouraging the malveh to lend the money. And the malveh, at the prodding of the guarantor, agrees or is willing to lend the money to the loveh. And so in essence, because of the hana'ah that he gets, because the creditor relies on him, that consideration, that hana'ah, is enough to obligate him when the malveh then gives the money to the loveh, because he's really acting almost as a proxy or an emissary of the guarantor, but then give it to the loveh instead of to the arev. So now the Gemara continues with the discussion of the Mishnah. If he makes a condition, a stipulated condition, that he's allowed to collect from whomever he chooses, meaning whether it's the Arev or the Loveh, then the Tanakhama says that he collects from whomever he wants. Now we have a qualification of that. Amar Rabba Bar Chana Rab Yochanan. It's only true when the Loveh has no possessions. But if the Loveh has possessions, Loi param in arev, then he doesn't have a right to collect from the guarantor. V'had mitani seifa, does that really make sense to explain the Tanakhama's position in that manner? What about the statement right after that in the Mishnah? Shem Gamliel Omer, im yesh nechasim loveh. If the loveh has possessions, loi param in arev. He may not collect from the arev, michlal. From that you would infer the Tanakhama savar lo shna hachi v'lo shna hachi. That the Tanakhama is indifferent between those two, and you have a right to go after the Loveh, or to go after the Arev, which would be against the qualification of Rabba Bar Chana, Rabbi Yochanan, which says that the Tanakhama believes that if the Loveh has assets, you have to go after the Loveh first. So my answer is, Chasurei Mechsera, the Mishnah was missing some transition wording that would help them explain it. V'Hochiktani, this is what is meant. Hamavet Chaveiro Ayadei Arev, person who lends money to his friend with a guarantor, lo yiparam in arev. He doesn't have a right to go after the arev. V'im amar, amenat she'epara mimi she'erze. If he stipulates the condition that I have a right to collect from whomever I choose, yiparam in arev. He has the right to go and collect even from the arev. Bamed varim amurim. When is that true? Beshe'en nechasim leloveh. When the loveh has no possessions. But if the loveh does have possessions, lo yipara min arev, then he does not have a right to go after the arev. The kablan, and this is the missing transition over there, the kablan again, which we saw before with Yehuda, and we're going to see tomorrow's daf as well, is an individual who is not just an arev, but also a kablan, where in essence, he's not really just a guarantor. It's as if he's a party or a co-signer to the loan. In that situation, this kablan, even though the debtor has possessions by which to repay the loan, yiparam in a kablan. He has a right, the malveh, to go after whichever party he chooses, and in this case, it's more convenient or easier for him to go after the kablan. But that's what the Tana Kama says, that he has a right to do so. And then along comes Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel Omer, Yesh nechasim leloveh, if the loveh has property, echad zeh ve'echad zeh lo yipra mehen, then you don't have a right to go after the arev until you've exhausted the possibilities with the loveh. There's a very large Tosafot over here where the Rabbeinu Tam lays out that there are really five different categories of guarantors over here that you can break down their dinim based on what we saw in the Gemara. He first clarifies and says that when the Gemara says loveh has no possessions, what it means is that he has no karkot, he has no real property, he does not have land. And that can explain why, even though the loveh has no possessions, quote-unquote, no possessions, he has no karka, doesn't mean he has no means or by which to pay back, we would still demand of the malveh to go after the loveh. Because there are other assets or there are other monies that he could go after, because the fact that we said he doesn't have nechasim, it just means that he doesn't have property. And then the Rabbeinu Tam lays out the five categories in the following manner. The first one is a person who lends money, a yedei arev, with a guarantor, and he doesn't make any stipulations about who he can collect from, and then the loveh defaults. In that case, there's an obligation on the malveh to take the loveh to Beit Din. He's obligated, no matter how difficult it is, no matter how much trouble he has to go through, he has to first exhaust the, you know, possibilities of claims against the loveh. And in that case, if he can't, through Beit Din and through all these other means, get the loveh to pay, then the creditor can go after the arev, or ask the arev to pay up. And so, if the debtor is someone who doesn't care about what Beit Din says, or Beit Din can't compel the loveh to repay over here, in that case, the malveh would then have a right to go after the arev. So that's category one. Category two is if the malveh stipulated that he go after whomever he chooses, then in that case, if the loveh has nechasim, which we just explained means that if the loveh has karkot, then the malveh will be obligated, the creditor will be obligated to go after those properties. But if the loveh does not have property, then the creditor has a right to go after the loveh or the arev, whoever he finds easier to deal with or whoever he chooses to collect from. The third category is the case where the loveh has property. Then, if the loveh has property, even in a case where the malveh, the creditor, had made that stipulation he could collect from whoever he chooses, nevertheless, he will have to go after the loveh first because the loveh has available property. The fourth category is a kablan, which we're going to see on tomorrow's daf is a kablan, which is this stronger form of a revolt where he really has made himself a party to the transaction. So in that situation, whether the debtor has property or whether the debtor does not have property or does not have possessions, he has a right to go after the arev, or here the kablan first. And the fifth category is, nosev notein biyad ipara min arev lo min aloveh. In a case where he physically got involved in the transaction of taking the item and then passing it on to the loveh, then in that case, the primary party that interfaced with the malveh, with the creditor, is the arev. And therefore, the malveh, the creditor in that case, will only have the right to go after the arev, since the creditor has no relationship with the debtor, because everything passed through the arev. So in that case, the creditor would be compelled to go after the arev first. And then if he can't get anything out of the arev, he can go after the loveh, mishibuda de Rabbi Natan, from the transitive property of Rabbi Natan, which says that if A owes money to B and B owes money to C, then in essence, A also owes money to C. And because of Rabbi Natan, C can go and try to collect the money from A directly. And similarly over here, he first has to go after the arev. But if the arev doesn't do it, who was the intermediary between him and the final party, then he can go after to the loveh because the loveh owes the money to the arev, and the arev owes the money to the creditor. And so then it becomes that transitive property where he can go after the loveh, even though his first right of collection was the arev, and in this case, the exclusive right of collection. Nevertheless, he can get to the loveh through, basically, the arev. Since he owes money to the arev, then you are a creditor to the arev. Therefore, by definition, you're a creditor to the loveh. And then the Rabbeinu Tam points out, the kulu arevin, all guarantors, by kinyan, They all require a kinyan in order to obligate themselves. Bar mi kablan, v'arev b'shat matan ma'ot, with the exception of a guarantor who are a party to the extension of the loan. Or in essence, the malveh, the creditor, relied on these guarantors in order to facilitate the loan that they're going to extend. And we said before that there you don't need a kinyan because the hana'a that the arev gets from them relying on him and believing him is enough for him to obligate himself to guarantee the loan that is about to be extended. And that's what generates the gemir tadat of the kinyan. But in the other instances, you will require a kinyan in order to generate the obligation of arevut. And the Reb points out that even though we believe that a kablan needs a kinyan, if in a shtar, an individual is called a kablan or says he obligated himself as a kablan, even though it doesn't explicitly use a language that we're going to see in tomorrow's daf, which is what makes the individual into a kablan versus an arev, nevertheless, since the shtar specifically states that he is a kablan and not an arev, we're going to believe that that's what happened or that's what transpired, and we will consider him to be a kablan and not an arev. Amar Rabbi Barchan, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, any time that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel appears in the Mishnah, as the Rashbam points out, and we've made this point before, that's only true in Mishnatenu, in Mishnayot, but not in Braitot. Halacha kemoto, the halacha will always be like him, chutz me'arev, v'tzidon, v'raya achrona. And obviously this is brought over here, because one of the three exceptions is our Mishnah over here, and that's the first, chutz me'arev, with the exception of the case of the guarantor. Over here, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes that you always have to exhaust the possibilities with the loveh, with the debtor first. And on that, we say that normally the halacha would be like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel when he appears in the Mishnah. But this is one of the exceptions where we don't say that the arev has those protections. And we paskin like the Tana Kama. The other two cases, one of them is Tzidon, which is a situation, a masebet Tzidon, that happens in the Mishnah and Gittin with regards to a husband that made a tnai with regards to a get. And over there, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel has an opinion, and they say the halacha is not like him. And then in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, there are two Mishnayot that discuss about bringing proofs or evidentiary claims of the parties. And over there, in the second Mishnah, Raya Achrona, the second Mishnah, where Rabbi Shimon Gamliel appears, the halacha is not like him in that situation. Okay, we're going to stop here, five lines down, on the top of Kufayin Dalet, Amud Aleph.